Hi, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. What page were we on last week? I have a printout from the original manuscript, so it doesn't have the big book page on it.
62.
So we're going to start on the paragraph that says, when we sincerely took such a position. That's how it's going to read in your book. It's slightly different in the original manuscript. Everybody got it?
Yeah.
Top of 63.
Top of 63? Okay, great. So just as a quick aside, for those of you who've never been here before, this is a slightly atypical meeting in that we do a big book workshop where we basically break down the book as our experience has shown it. Different speakers come in on different cycles, and we'll do anything from 3 weeks to 15 weeks. We're doing something a little bit different this time. We're breaking down the manuscript, which is the predecessor to the big book. So if it seems a little odd or not your normal AA meeting, this is what we do here. This meeting will run until approximately 7:45. It means an hour and 15 minutes, so if you need to get out of here at 7:30, feel free to get up and quietly go. Having said that, I'm going to read exactly as it is and there's some very important parts that we're going to read the next couple of paragraphs where there's a lot of direction. Chris so eloquently put it that this whole manuscript was about direction. You know, when Bill wrote it, it was about, you're going to do this, or you're going to have this experience. It was very upfront and in-your-face kind of stuff. And it got softened when it got passed around and people looked at it and said, okay, well, maybe we don't want to piss off the newcomer. Let's just make it a little easier for him to hear. But in these couple of paragraphs that we're going to cover, which is the launching pad for inventory, it's going to sound like, out of the original manuscript, a very much more direct than what you read in the big book today. So, starting on when you sincerely take such a position, all sorts of remarkable things follow. You have a new employer. Being all-powerful, he must necessarily provide what you need if you keep close to him and perform his work well. Established in such a footing, you become less and less interested in yourself. Your little plans and designs, more and more, you become interested in seeing what you can contribute to life. As you feel new power flow in, as you enjoy peace of mind, as you discover you face life successfully, as you become conscious of the presence presence, fear of today, tomorrow, or hereafter, you will have been reborn. And the final sentence now in the big book is we were reborn. So it's pretty much in your face, isn't it, compared to what you're reading in that paragraph in the big book. You know, it's much more inclusive in the big book. So what's he trying to state to us? And we know about Bill's nature, don't we? We know about the first time that he went out to sponsor people. What did he do? He pissed them off, right? I mean, the first 6 months that he was out trying to get new guys to come join his movement, he had no success. It wasn't until he met Dr. Bob and he says, I need you to help me to start to have some success. And this is why we see this kind of transition. But let's ask ourselves this question. Is this true in our lives, right? If you've had a spiritual experience, if you're moving towards a spiritual awakening, is this true? I can tell you this much for me. It's absolutely undeniably true. And I can say this quite emphatically. These things have happened. Next paragraph. Now here's where we're going to say the third step prayer. Get down upon your knees and say to your Maker, as you understand Him, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Think well before taking this step. Be sure you are ready, that you can at last abandon yourself utterly to Him. Sounds a little different, doesn't it? Right? Very direct. Right? But let's talk about the third step prayer for a second. Let's actually read the third step prayer as it says in the big book today. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. In my understanding, in the understanding that I've been given of a higher power in my life, it has become very evident to me that I had, at best, a poor understanding of what that higher power looked like. And throughout this book, the presentation of God is one of absolute power. Anybody disagree with that? Right? There's this idea that God has all power, and that He is a creator of all things. And I that rankled me for a long time. And for a long while, I had trouble with that. But it was only in taking the time to kind of free myself of my old ideas of what this idea of a higher power is going to look like for me, was I able to get to a place where the higher power of my understanding did have absolute power. I used to think that a higher power only had to have a little bit more power than me. Right? Just a little bit more power would be okay, because I knew my power was insufficient. And for a time, that kind of carried me in my journey, because I couldn't really get with the whole idea of an all-powerful, all-loving God. It just wasn't in my bailiwick. It wasn't something that I could wrap my hands around. Infinity was difficult for me to understand. It was a little larger than the things I've been dealing with, you know? And I had this difficulty in wrapping my hands around it. And what ended up happening was I finally got to the place where I was able to discard all this kind of thought process that I had gone through about what my higher power was supposed to look like. And I started to get with the idea that a higher power in my life looked like a creator of the universe, an infinite amount of power. And I started to think to myself, you know, I understand this. I finally am starting to have an experience with God that I understood, right? And it was a really freeing thing until I heard this speaker on tape talk about the third step. And it kind of blew the top of my head off, because I began to understand what he was talking about, right? And what he said to me in this tape, not to me personally, but in this tape, was how arrogant of me to think that I can give my life over to God. How arrogant is that? How much of an alcoholic do I have to be to think that way? And I started to think about that, and it started to make a tremendous amount of sense to me. Somehow, what I think has gone on is that I've taken from God, who has infinite power and an ability to create at whim anything, right? My life from Him. Right? How crazy is that? That in my small mind. Now, when I was using a lot of PCP, and I was hanging out in my mom's bedroom, in my mom's house and in my bedroom, thinking that somehow I was the incarnation of the Antichrist, you know, I was wondering where I was going to get the power to end the world, right? And I had this delusion about what kind of power I have, and it seems to have always followed me through all the things that I've done. So here I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm finally comfortable with this idea that I have this idea that, I've gotten with God and everything's okay, and that somehow I, in my existence, had the power to rip from God my life. And now I'm being so gracious as to give it back to Him. That I'm being so gracious as to offer up my life. Well, you know what, God? You can have this. You know, I'll give you the whole thing, in fact. I'll give you the part that has to do with money, relationships, job, you know, my ability to have relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll give you all that. Isn't that kind of me, God? Isn't that gracious? Right? What I started to realize, what the third step actually meant to me, was that I was going to be free of the delusion that I ever had any control over any of this at any given point. That this had already been a gift, it had always been a gift, and it had been something that had been graciously given to me. And I was the only person in the room who thought that I had any control over it. I was the only person in the room who thought that I was driving the bus. Right? I'm the only person. Right? And that's the delusion, and that's where I live, and that's the mindset I have. And how am I going to get free of that? I'm going to get free of that in inventory. But it was a humbling moment for me when I suddenly understood that I had literally had no part in this whole thing, and that the only way that I could ruin this was by not recognizing it for what it was. Right? I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I was describing some trials and tribulations that were going on, and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear about you spending time in the dark." And I immediately replied to her, I said, "There is nothing but light. I'm the only person who can spend time in the dark, and that's only in my mind. Because the world about me is true and it's real, but I'm the guy who shuts it off." That's my understanding of the third step now. It is very desirable that you make your decision with an understanding person. It may be your wife, your best friend, your spiritual advisor, but remember, it is better to meet God alone that with one who might misunderstand. You must decide this for yourself. The wording of your decision is, of course, quite optional. As long as you express the idea of voicing it without reservation, this decision is only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, in effect sometimes a very great one, will be felt at once. Next, we launch out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which you have never in all probability attempted. Well, actually, that was accurate. Though your decision is a vital and crucial step, it can have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in yourself, right? The key word there, by the way, is yourself, which have been blocking you. And once again, we're being blocked from God. Your liquor is but a symptom. Let's now get down to basic causes and conditions. The basic causes and conditions are not the things that exist on the surface. They're not the thing. It's not the event. Gee, I want to be free of being mad at Bob because Bob looked at me funny at the meeting. Right? That's not the cause and the condition. Right? If I'm going to look at the cause and the condition, I'm going to have to do a little more work than praying for him. Right? You ever walk into a meeting and have somebody say, "Well, pray for them." Why don't you shut up? Why don't you just shut your stupid mouth? Your pile should be shut right now. I'm not going to pray for him. I'm going to hunt him down when no one's looking. If I wait 2 years, no one will remember just how pissed I am, and they won't be able to track the murder down to me. You know, these are the thoughts I had, you know, in the early years or last week. You know, I mean, it's just... The cause is not what comes out on the surface. That's like the drinking, right? Alcohol doesn't have anything to do with my alcoholism except to try to put an end to the pain, right? The problem for me is what happens underneath the hood. It's what happens when I am separated from God. Because if I am truly connected to God, what ends up happening is I don't have these thoughts. That has been my experience. I don't have conflict with you. It is only when ego remanifests that I have conflict with you. It is only when I start to care about the outcome and want to manage or control that outcome. It's only when I want you guys to do as I want you to do that you suddenly aren't doing enough. Right? The events are never the problem. You ever work with somebody who wants to tell you about the same event time and time again? You ever go to the meeting where the individual is talking about her or about him, complaining about them? You know, my neighbor doesn't like my cat. Oh, goody. We'll hear about that for the 17th time. That's going to help me fight off the four horsemen and the demons who are clutching at my throat and want to cause me to go out and drink and you know, steal cars and murder, right? That'll help me, your cat, right? Those events are never the problems. The times that I've had conflicts with people were never the problems. Every single problem I ever had came from a series or a chain of things that will lead me back to a basic problem that I have. And my basic problem is a disconnect from God. It'll show up in a variety of different ways, either through lust, through anger, through greed, through gluttony. You know, any one of the seven deadly sins are usually a pipeline for me. You know, the event is not even a leaf on the tree, right? If you do that four-column inventory and you get to the column, how does it affect you? And you write down self-esteem. Oh, now we're talking about a leaf. Right? Well, let's talk about the branch that leaf comes off of. Let's talk about the limb that's connected to that branch. And let's talk about the trunk. But where are the roots? Where are the roots for me? The roots for me is that I'm trying to be in control of something that has that is beautiful and perfect already.
My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
You know, just to, every single time I go through this work, you know, the definition of a spiritual classic is a book that'll speak to you where you are and will speak to you as you develop. And I've gone through this book a million times, and what's really jumping out at me this time is, in the original manuscript, how many times it called the third step a decision. They changed that in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, but they're very, very specific in calling the third step a decision. You need to make your decision. Are you going to be willing to go to any lengths? Are you in or are you out? Alcoholics Anonymous has a suggested 12-step program of recovery. Are you in or are you out? And in this original manuscript, it says, get down on your knees. This is what Dr. Bob would do. Dr. Bob would have you make a decision to join AA. And the decision to join AA had less to do with attending meetings than it had to do with moving forward with the spiritual program of recovery. So when you made your decision, you were pretty serious about, okay, I'm in. You know, my way has not been working. I can't seem to separate from alcohol. My life is unmanageable. I'm in. And so in the original manuscript, they called it this decision at least four times. It's funny. In the chapter Working with Others, it basically says, if your man wants to make a decision with you, go ahead. And if you just read the big book without using this as a reference point, you won't know what they're talking about in chapter 7. If a person is to make a decision, it means they're gonna do the third step prayer. And the third step prayer is saying, I'm in. I'm in. I'm going to seek God through the practice of these spiritual principles and these spiritual steps. Now, has anybody in here ever been asked the age-old question, what is wrong with you? Does that ring a bell? Has anyone ever asked you that? I will tell you right now, is if they were talking about how your alcoholism was presenting, and they're asking you what is wrong with you, you didn't know how to answer. We don't really know what to say. We know how to deflect that. And we deflect it by saying stuff like, what are you talking about? You know, leave me alone. It's none of your business. I'm only hurting myself. Stay away from me. I mean, that's how we deflect. But when we're asked that question, we really don't know. Now, I'll tell you this. If you've never done a four-step inventory like we're going to start talking about tonight, you don't know what's wrong with you. Because it's this fourth step that shows us what's wrong with us as alcoholics. So many of us think that our case is different. I've done so many talks at treatment centers, and I've worked with so many newcomers. I know that the flag we wave as brand new alcoholics is basically, my case is different. You know, I understand that these 12 steps work for people like you, Dave, but I am a little... I'm alcoholic. But I'm also, all this other stuff. And this is typical. If you've thought this way, welcome. That's the membership exam. You know, you thinking your case is different. The brilliant, wonderful, amazing part of this four-step is it speaks to all of us and it points out at the causes and conditions of what our failure at life have been. There's three basic parts in the fourth step. Our anger, our resentment, our fear, our anxiety, and our conduct. How do we comport ourselves, especially in intimate relationships, especially in sexual relationships? Those are the three Megillas, because I'll just quickly explain to you why these are so important to inventory and how these things almost took me out. All right, here I am. I'm spinning dry, sober, unrecovered, just completely crazed out of my mind, and I know that I'm drinking myself to death in a bad, bad way. I detoxed myself on the floor as the first moment I could. I got myself to an AA meeting, and something inside me was telling me that this AA stuff probably is not going to work. It's too weird. You know, I don't relate to the people, but I got no other plans. And I don't want to drink myself to death, and I don't want to hurt anybody, you know, while I'm doing it, because I was growing increasingly violent. So what I did was I went off to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me things like, you know, do 90 and 90. Meeting makers make it. You know, here's my phone number. People were asking me, Chris, what meeting are you going to tomorrow? I was being encouraged to be fellowshipping, to stay close to you all. That's not a bad suggestion. Now, but here's the thing. I'm a real alcoholic, and I'm suffering from anger and resentment. I'm suffering from fear and self-centered fear and anxiety, and I'm suffering from guilt, shame, and remorse because of my conduct. Now, this is how all that stuff almost took me out. I join a home group. It's the Morristown Friday Night Group, and I join this group, and it's the January of 1990, and I'm going to this group for 2 or 3 months, and there's a group of clicky old timers who really aren't paying much attention to me. They're the coffee makers. They've been there for 100 years. You know, they're just doing fine, and they don't want to get involved really in much. And then there was a younger group of people. They were like 10 years younger than me, and it looked like they were hooking up with each other after every meeting and, you know, just hanging out like, hey, there's a party. And I felt really like out of touch with them. I felt like I was too old for them. So I felt like I was stuck in the middle, and I started to get pissed off. You know, this meeting's clicky, and I don't like how they do this. And, you know, nobody's paying any attention to me, and the newcomer's supposed to be the most important person in the room. Screw these bastards. I'm out of here. Mm. All right? Resentment drove me out of that home group. The only thing that saved my life is I joined another home group. Now, I joined this other home group, and this is a home group where I'm invited in. You know, it's the same kind of socioeconomic age group, and I kind of get invited in. And I'm a little bit more sober now. I'm about 6 months sober. Come on in. Well, what happened is about 8 months, they started to have those slow, painful, root canal-esque business meetings. Have you ever been to groups where there's, like, contentious business meetings? Well, there was this asshole in this one group who was so worried about the treasury report. You know, I want to know what's happening with my money. With your $1, you know, you're ready to blow this group apart because you want to know what's happening with your $1. You know, so he's, I want treasury reports. It says in the tradition book, you know, and people are freaking out. And the group went from like 100 people down to about 20. It was the Myersville Friday Night Group, right? And I couldn't take it after a while. Listen, I'm unrecovered. I'm being drawn into this. I'm pissed now, you know, that this jerk, you know, is ruining my serenity because of a dollar. So I'm out of here, you know, and I leave the meeting because I'm pissed. Now, I'm leaving the thing that's keeping me alive. You know, this is what resentments can do. And the only thing I did right was I joined another home group. I joined the Burnsville Friday Night High Bottom group. And in that group, I went through the steps so I never had to leave another group. Because the steps teach you how to deal with these resentments. That's how resentments almost killed me. Here's how fear almost killed me. I had anxiety and self-centered fear all over me. But when if you asked me, Chris, do you suffer from fear? I'd be like, hell no. You know, I'd go after the biggest guy in the bar. I raced motorcycles and snowmobiles, and I bridge jumped and skied moguls and anything crazy. I was there, you know, broken bones all the time. I was as daring as could be. So if you're trying to pin fear on me, it wasn't computing. But I was so uncomfortable I couldn't go into a grocery store. Because of the fluorescent lights, you know what I mean? And then there's fluorescent lights, and there's all these different packages, and people with carts trying to run all around you. You know, you ever see an empty shopping cart in a shopping center? I know the guy, you know. I know what they felt like. They just had to get out, you know. Well, that's anxiety. That's fear, okay? So I'm going into AA meetings, and I don't like crowds. I don't like big meetings, and I don't like people looking at me, and and the other looking at me, and I'm afraid to share because if somebody says, oh, you know, somebody's going to share right after me and say, you know, what Chris said was kind of stupid. I used to be stupid like Chris, and then I'd have to get into a fight, and then I'd have to leave the meeting. And, you know, I'm worrying about all this stuff, and I can't get up to go to the bathroom because people look, where's he going? You know, where the hell is he going? So all this stuff is going through my head. I can't even listen at the meeting. You know what I mean? And I'm telling you, it was really uncomfortable. That a year into AA, I would drive up to a meeting and I'd be doing this. You know, do I really want to go tonight? You know, God, I got to walk down those stairs. And there's all those people. I mean, this is fear. This is anxiety, and it almost killed me because it almost pulled me away from the thing that was keeping me alive, which was Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I finally go through the steps, and now I don't give a shit what other people think. I'm not worried about going anywhere because these steps teach you how to deal with your anxiety and your fear. Now, I hooked up with a woman. I was about a year sober, and I saw her as God's will for me right at that moment. Mm. And this is a beautiful example of two ding-a-lings trying to make a bell. And boy meets girl on AA campus, and you know the Hindenburg crashes soon afterward, and that's exactly what happened. I had become kind of bonded with this girl because, you know, it's the first woman I'd been intimate with, and you know, since I was like blackout drunk for many, many years, and the breakup caused me unbelievable pain. You, I'm sure everybody in here has, knows that kind of pain, and I now half of the meeting got to, you know, who gets custody of the meetings and all this other mess, all this other stuff, and I've got people coming up to me saying, you know, she didn't have a year, you know, you deserve this, and I'm like, you know, it was really, really tough to get through. Now, the third part of this inventory is they ask us to look in a very, very detailed way about our behavior in these relationships. What do we do wrong? You know, because we don't get into relationships as alcoholics. We take hostages, you know, and it blows up in our face. And so this particular inventory asks me to look at all this stuff so that I don't drive myself out of AA because of my behavior. It's a conduct inventory. Now, it says in our book, and I'm jumping probably a week ahead here, but it says, if your conduct continues to harm others, you are quite sure to drink. This is not a theory. It's facts based on our experience. So if you're going to be targeting individuals, you know, to have intimate relationships with without considering them, their welfare, their feelings, or anything like that, and you continue to do that, you will not make it. If you're an alcoholic, you are going to get drunk. Now, every once in a while, we see predators in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who just nail one person after another, and they seem fine, right? They are not alcoholics. They don't belong in our rooms, and they're not alcoholics. Our book tells us that if conduct continues to harm others, especially in relationships, those people are going to drink. So if they're not drinking, don't feel bad about asking them to get the hell out of your closed meeting, because they're obviously not alcoholics. And we've seen these predators. We all have. And sometimes we wonder, well, why the hell are they still here? Why the hell don't they get drunk? Well, it's because they're not really alcoholic. There are a lot of people that are in AA for reasons other than recovering from alcoholism. That's just the way it is, and we need to know that. Now, therefore, you start upon a personal inventory. This is step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. Its object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We do exactly the same thing with our lives. We take stock honestly. First, we search out the flaws in our makeup which have caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us, we consider its common manifestations. You know, the funny thing about this recovery process is it does not say that alcohol is our problem. It says that selfishness and self-centeredness is our problem. Now that's really weird, because I came into AA because I was drinking myself to death, and now you're telling me my real problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. Listen, for the longest time, I believed I was an alcoholic because I drank a lot of alcohol. I drank a quart of hard liquor a day for, 8 years. That's why I thought I was an alcoholic. Today, I believe that I drank a quart of whiskey every night because I'm an alcoholic. Now, those are two different things. But if you don't have it right, you've got the wrong problem. If you think you're an alcoholic because you drank a lot of booze, if you take the booze away, you're going to be all right. But if you think you drank the booze because you're an alcoholic, if you take the booze away, you still have the problem. Now, I'm going to still have the problem when I take the booze away. I was no vision for you in my first year. I got to tell you, I was a mess. I was a mess. Just critically damaged. Emotionally, spiritually, mentally, and physically. So I've got to understand the problem, or I'm going to be working on the wrong solution. If you're listening to people tell you that just don't take the first drink and everything's going to be fine, they're allowing you to believe that your problem is alcohol. Listen, my problem was not alcohol. And I'll explain that with a very short story. I would come to in the morning wearing the clothes I was in the night before. I would stagger into the bathroom and do my vomiting calisthenics. I'd get into my $100 car and I'd go to my terrible job as a bad electrician. All morning long I'd be swearing to God I'm not going to drink tonight because I don't want to feel like this again tomorrow. I feel horrible. I'm poisoned. Alcohol has poisoned me. What would happen though is 4:30, it'd be coming real soon, and by that time I had talked myself into stopping at the liquor store on the way home from work. Okay, I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't quit. I swore to God I would quit in the morning, and I was on the way to the liquor store 6 hours later. Okay, that's what an alcoholic does. Now, I would get to the liquor store, and I remember this one time there's somebody in line in front of me at the liquor store and asking questions about what kind of wine goes with tilapia, and I'm just freaking out. I'm like, I don't give a shit what kind of wine goes with tilapia. Just give that lady a bottle of Gallo and get her out of here. You got a vodka buyer here, all right? I'm a vodka buyer. Who gives a crap about some wine lady? I need to buy this booze. I got a problem. I'm sober. Okay, move her out of here so I can take care of this sobriety crap. I was sober and listen, does that sound like the problem is alcohol? I don't think so. The problem is chronic selfishness and self-centeredness making me believe that, I am the center of the universe and it's a hostile universe and everything is closing in on me and, it's me. That's what's causing this spiritual, mental, emotional, psychic trauma that I need to get a quart of whiskey to pour down my throat to be able to tolerate life. That's what my problem is, and that's what this inventory takes care of. I can now stand in line like a normal person and say, I don't care if somebody has 15 items in a 13 item line. I don't care anymore. It doesn't matter. It's not some desperate need for somebody to not inconvenience me. Like there used to be. There's healing in this inventory because you get to see it for what it is. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. It's funny, it doesn't say alcohol destroys more alcoholics than anything else. It says resentments destroy more alcoholics than anything else. I almost resented myself out of Alcoholics Anonymous. It would have been absolutely true that resentment would have killed me if that would have happened. You know, listen, there's at least 10 million people out there in North America today who have tried Alcoholics Anonymous and they would tell you to your face AA didn't work for them. All of those people, except maybe a very few, the vast majority of those people are people who never did this work. They're not part of the rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. They're people who tried to address their alcoholism by meeting attendance. Meetings don't treat alcoholism. What they do is they create a sober environment where hopefully you can get discover and become enthusiastic enough to take the steps so that you can recover from alcoholism. Just going to meetings is just going to prolong the inevitable. And what happens to the alcoholic of this variety that they're talking about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, if you just stay sober and don't have a fundamental psychic change, a fundamental spiritual change, what will happen is you will slowly deteriorate to the point where you'll take your own life, you'll go crazy, or you'll drink again. One of those three things will happen. How many people in here have seen that happen to people in the rooms? They come for a while. Sometimes they even look like they're halfway doing okay. And then you hear they've put a bullet through their head. Or they're in Happy Hills. Or they're drunk again. We cannot tolerate reality without some kind of spiritual help. We can't. Sobriety is untenable at a certain point for an alcoholic. That's why we drink. So we need something. We need something spiritual. Just like, listen, alcohol. Why do you think they call alcohol spirits? There's spirituality in that bottle until you become a puking animal. Mm. You know, when you allow yourself to become overserved like I used to do. But there's some spiritual relief with alcohol. Well, we need that relief to be able to deal. We just need a healthier form of spiritual relief. We need what is known as a spiritual awakening. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these 12 steps, you know, we need that spiritual awakening. That's what the treatment for alcoholism is, a spiritual awakening. A treatment for alcoholism is not sobriety. You don't fight alcoholism with sobriety. You fight it with a spiritual experience. That's the genius of what Bill and Bob and the early guys figured out. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. List people, institutions, or principles with whom you are angry. Ask yourself why you are angry. In most cases, it will be found that your self-esteem, your pocketbook, your ambitions, your personal relationships, including sex, are hurt or threatened. So you are sore, you are burned up. Let's just look at those really closely. Self-esteem. Self-esteem is how I feel about myself. Pocketbook, that's our economic security, okay? My ambitions is basically what I want to get. Personal relationships are, you know, friends, work, co-workers. Sex relationships are the people that we're close to. If these are hurt or threatened, if we perceive them as being hurt or threatened, we get pissed. We don't get pissed unless one of these things happen. You're not going to get angry with somebody if something isn't harm, threatened, or interfered with that you either have or that you want. So it's the things that you have that you want to protect or the things that you want to get. If those things are harm, threatened, or interfered with in any way, you're going to get pissed. So we need to look at this, and we need to be able to analyze when we get angry. We need to be able to analyze why we're angry. We need to look at it and see it all the way through. Because the truth about these resentments will give us mastery over them. I really believe that. On your grudge list, set opposite each name your injuries. Is it your self-esteem, your security, your ambitions, your personal or your sexual relations which have been interfered with? Be as definite as this example. I'm resentful at Mr. Brown. His attentions to my wife, self-esteem, fear, affects my sexual relations. Okay? Told my wife of my mistress, self-esteem, fear, sexual relations. Brown may get my job at the office, self-esteem, fear, security, and self-esteem. The best t-shirt I ever saw at an AA convention was Mr. Brown needs his ass kicked. I love that. Mrs. Jones, she's a nut. She snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking and he's my friend. She's a gossip. That affects my personal relationships, self-esteem, fear. My employer is unreasonable, unjust, overbearing, threatens to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account. Self-esteem, fear, security. My wife misunderstands and nags. Likes Brown, wants a house put in her name. This affects my sex relations, pride, security, and personal relationships. Now, what I want to be very, very clear on is, look at the economy. This is like less than 60 words, this fourth step, okay? I have sat with people who've had, you know, like books written as part of their fourth step. There's an economy and a simplicity to this particular type of an inventory. There are no wasted words here. We need to get down to the main details. We're not looking for a life story. If someone has told you that a fourth step is a life story, it's probably a bad treatment center or someone that went to a bad treatment center. Because an AA four step, it has an economy to it, a simplicity to it, and a directness to it. You know, there he said a lot of things here in 60 words. He didn't mince a lot of words. Go on through the list, back through your lifetime. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. When you are finished, consider it carefully. The first thing apparent to you is that the world and its people are quite wrong. To conclude, others are wrong is as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome is that people continue to wrong you and you stay sober. Sometimes it is remorse and then you are sore at yourself. But the more you fight and try to have your way, the worse matters get. Isn't that so? As in war, victors only seem to win. Your moments of triumph are short-lived. It is plain that a way of life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? Let me show you an example from my own personal experience about that. That is so true. If we are going to always be pissed, we are wasting our life. I would come to in the morning, you know, because I'd been drunk and I was always pissed off. And I would come to in the morning and I'd lift my head off the pillow and the first thing that would go through my head was this. Those bastards! That's the first thing I would think about. It would have to do with people at work or my ex-wife who left me when I needed her most or my friends who were all jerks. I mean, it would come right into my head who I'm mad at. And that's how I would start my day. Being pissed off. Now, listen, I lost a whole decade. The entire 80s are a wash for me because I was drinking so bad and there was absolutely nothing I accomplished in the 80s. Nothing positive came out of the 80s at all for me because this stuff was so alive in me. And what they're saying is you squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. When you have these type of belief systems. But with the alcoholic whose only hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We find that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. We resent ourselves right back to the bottle. Most people that leave AA leave with a resentment. Most of them do. I just, and sometimes it's almost valid. You know, I can't tell you how many people that I talk to in treatment centers who say, look, I went to AA. You know, all it was one person bitching about something after the other. You know, if it wasn't the fan belt on their Mercedes, it was their tennis pro being rude. You know, I couldn't take it anymore, you know. And listen, there are terrible meetings out there, folks. I am not somebody that believes that every AA meeting is a good meeting. There are some just god-awful, horrible-ass meetings that if you go to, you're going to come out worse than you went in. There are. They're bad, bad meetings where people do not understand what Alcoholics Anonymous is even about. They all they've had is bad therapy, and they come in and they go to a discussion meeting and they think that that's what AA is. You know, bad group therapy without a licensed professional to coach the people through. And I understand when people say that. And I basically tell them this. I go, look, when you look through the meeting book, start off with some big book meetings. You know, start off with some step meetings or something. You know, stay away from the discussion meetings. You know, and if you go to some beginners meetings, make sure that there's some focus with the beginners meetings. Because people do not understand that these bad meetings blow people out. You can kill people. You can kill people by promoting a bad meeting because they're not going to understand why the hell should I stay? This has nothing to do with my problem. I don't care about, you know, somebody's fan belt. And they leave and then they go and they tell everybody at the bar that AA doesn't work. You know, and we're, you know, once more we're killing people and not even knowing it. You know, so whenever I'm in treatment, I point people to the big book groups. I point people to the solution groups, because it can be life or death for these people. You know, I didn't know, I tried AA in 1984. I went to an AA meeting, and this is basically what happened. I'm gonna turn it over to Dave after I tell this story. I'm drinking like a fish, okay? A buddy shows up, knocks on my door. He's got no place to live. I move him into my house, and he sees my drinking, and he sees how bad it is. I'm tongue-chewing, knee-walking drunk by 7 o'clock every night. You know what I mean? I'm blackout drunk by 7 o'clock every night. And I talk him in. You know, we talk together, and we decide we're going to go uptown to an AA meeting. Now, I walk into an AA meeting. Okay, you know, I sit down, and the first thing they do is they say a prayer. I'm in a church basement. They say a prayer. Listen, I haven't been to a church in 20 years, and it was hard for me just to walk through those doors. Okay, and now they're saying a prayer. I guess it was the Serenity Prayer. And then they open up the meeting, and you know, somebody had a resentment or something, and then somebody else had a resentment. Everybody, I have my resentment. And I'm listening to this stuff, right? And in the middle of the meeting, all of a sudden, a basket starts getting passed, and people are putting money in a basket. I know where that happens. That happens in church. Okay, they're praying and they're passing a basket around. That happens in church. I want nothing to do with church. You know, I hate church people. Now, at the end, everybody gets up, and I'm trying to find my way to the exit, and somebody grabs my hand, and I find that we're forming a big, giant circle. And all of a sudden, they start saying the Lord's Prayer on me. You know? And I got to tell you, I am the hell out of there for 6 more years. I'm out of there because that couldn't possibly work for me. That couldn't possibly be my answer. You know, one guy in that meeting came up to me and started to talk to me about sponsorship. He made the mistake of not talking to me about alcoholism. He was talking to me about sponsorship. Now, I used to race motorcycles, so what I thought a sponsor was somebody that gave you money to get to the race if you wear their shirt. And I'm thinking, I don't need money to get to the AA meeting. I lost my license for a DUI. I don't need this sponsor. I don't need the gas money. That's what I'm thinking. Listen, when somebody walks through the door, sometimes they can look cleaned up. They can look like they got their shit together, you know? But a lot of times they're just completely whacked out of their minds. And if we're going to take a meeting hostage talking about a fan belt on our Mercedes, those newcomers are going to absolutely know. They're going to know that there's no answer for them in this room. And again, I think it's really, really important for us to talk about what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. That's what the big book asks us to do. It does not ask us to get involved in bizarre Bob Newhart-esque therapy. Not that I judge. No. Dave will fix it.
I always like the scientific observation that Chris has about other meetings. You know, there's nothing but purity that comes out of his mouth and love. And it's the thing that drives me today and allows me to have a higher power. Yeah, I've learned everything I know from him. Who here has done at least, raise your hand, who here has done at least one full four step? Whether or not you actually gave it to anybody. Okay, great. Let me ask you a question. When you were approaching your first four step, did it look like climbing K2 or Mount Everest? Right? Were they using big words on you like resentments? Right? And were you having a hard time with the idea that you're going to actually do this? And were you having a hard time with the idea that you might actually do this incorrectly? That somehow this is going to be another notch in the I've done it wrong, you know, holster of my life. I remember my first sponsor, his name was Mike. It was 1985, and he was an attorney. And Mike the attorney, I guess, liked to see people write, because when I went to him and said I want to do a four-step, he said, okay, write about 25 pages, or whatever you told me to write. I wrote about 25 pages, and I showed up with Mike, you know, nervous as hell about doing a fifth step, and I go, this is what I've written. And Mike said, oh, go back and write some more. I said, okay, Mike, you're an attorney, I guess you're right. And off I paddled, and seven or eight voices following me in my head, and sat down and wrote another 25 pages and brought it to Mike. And Mike goes, oh, just write some more. Now I'm getting a resentment, right? I went back and wrote 25 more pages. It was a life story kind of thing, by the way. I wrote about 25 more pages, came back, and Mike told me, why don't you go write some more? And what I said to him was, okay. And what I thought to myself was, screw you, I'm out of here. You know, you're annoying. I don't like you, and I never did a four-step until 2004. You know, 19 years later. So a resentment will show up in my life in a variety of ways, and it'll poison me towards a process because I automatically, from one experience, will decide that it's not going to work for me. But when I came back in 2004 and I saw the fourth step, I thought it was still a mountain. I thought it was insurmountable in some ways. And I knew that the process wasn't broken. I knew that I was broken, that I was not going to deliver into this four-step an honest set of responses. You know, I didn't have a Mr. Brown in my life. You know, I didn't have a Mrs. Jones. I had just stuff that I just did not want to talk about. And in a lot of ways, you know, I had, if you ask me, I had no resentments because I had gotten even. Right? And getting even, I took great pleasure in. But I'm viewing this four step, and I'm viewing this thing as if getting over this is going to be this incredibly painful process. And I couldn't procrastinate anymore, because it was at a point in my life where, you know, my wife didn't want me around anymore, and the one thing I'd ask her is, what I can do? And she goes, why don't you try AA again? And I knew that in the previous time that I'd never gotten a sponsor or done the steps. I've been the coffee boy, you know, the conference guy, I would set up chairs, take chairs down. I'd do anything but the work. And hanging out with other people who had done the work was a fairly safe and protected spot until it wasn't. Until I couldn't stand the fan belt story anymore and I stopped going. But in this idea that I'm going to somehow do this work again, I was faced with having to do a four-step. And I knew the problem in this whole process was me. It wasn't the step. It wasn't my sponsor at the time. It was me. I was not going to deliver an honest response to it. But here's the interesting thing. So I understand a four-step now. You know, so we have four columns. If you do a four-column or if you do something else, that's cool, right? But I see it as a four-column inventory. That's the way I've been taught. It's four columns, right? Let's look at the first three columns for sake of argument. It says, list who I'm resentful at. Well, that's always easy. Right? You ever sit in a bar stool and tell them how much you hate your boss, hate your husband, hate your girlfriend, hate the guy next to you in the bar stool? Right? You ever tell them that? That first column is just those people I've always talked about. How hard can that be? Right? What's the second call? The second problem? The second column? Right? It's what they've done. And I would talk to you all night about what they did. Right? I got no problem with that. So the first two out of four columns are the easiest thing for me to talk about. It's how you guys have wronged me. Right? I did that in the bar stool for years. I did that any chance I got. Right? I did that in recovery. Talked about how the guy at the meeting looked at me funny, or they made a sly comment about big book people, or when I wasn't a big book guy, they made a sly comment about not being a big book guy, or whatever the case might be. There's always a sly comment somewhere in the rooms, right? So the first two columns are easy. They're darn easy. If you're sitting down and you're thinking about writing a four-step, just write at the people you're pissed at. Even if you're no longer pissed at them, even if you're spiritually bereft, you know, even if you're spiritually over these people, right? Write about the people you have been pissed at. Right? I found out that when I started, I did an honest four-step, that I've been pissed at just about everybody. Right? I was pissed at mom, I was pissed at dad, I was pissed at the grandparents, I was pissed at the sister, I was pissed at... I was pissed at everybody. The sponsor, the protege, the meeting, the coffee maker, you name it. There was basically nobody that wasn't on the list at one point or another. Never you, though. And I could write this stuff down kind of freely now. I was mad at the IRS, even though the IRS had never done anything to me. I was just mad because they had a set of rules I didn't like. They were taking my money. That bothered me. Right? I was mad at the employer. I was mad at people who did nothing but give me gifts my entire life. Absolutely did nothing but give me gifts. I had a resentment machine that churned out resentments at the drop of a hat. So the first two columns were really, really easy, right? But I had no idea how to tell you what that affected. I was so completely and utterly blocked by the concept of what could possibly be affected, but I just didn't know. So what did I get into the habit of doing? Well, there was this list of things right out of the big book, or you saw them out of a study guide. If you go to the wrong study guide, you'll find like 128 different things that can go into your third column. I've seen that, and I've gone, really? Interesting, right? But there's some basic stuff that'll end up in my third column, right? Self-esteem, personal relations. If I'm talking about personal relations, I'm not just talking about you guys, right? I'm talking about my relations with everybody outside of me. That includes God, right? I'm talking about everything that is possible for me to interact with. Could be the employer. It's not exclusive, right? We single out the people that we share ourselves with the sex relations, right? Because that seems to be on a deeper level. But beside that, personal relations for me is everybody else. Everybody else. And what is there in life but you, me, and God? Right? There's only three things. So I started to find that in my third column, I narrowed it down to certain things. What happened was I started to understand. I started to get that personal vision about what these character defects look like. And this only comes because I've become willing to look at my side of the coin. I've only become willing to admit that there were things that I was doing. Right? And I started to be able to look at the nature of the thing that I was resentful at. Now here's what started to really kind of change my perception about the third column. So I can write the first two columns really, really easily. They're the bar stool columns, right? I can write down anybody if I really want to get honest. But what about the third column? What does the third column look like? So if I'm mad at you, right, because you didn't do something or you did do something, right, how does that look when I'm younger? How does that look when I'm older? How does that look like in the pits of my alcoholism, my scaled down, you know, scrape along the bottom alcoholism? And how does that look like in recovery? Right? I can feel threatened on a different level in each case. So just because it's let's use financial insecurity as an example. What does financial insecurity look like when I get to the third column? Right? So it in and of itself has some attributes. It has fear as one of the attributes. Right? But in the third column, financial security looked a lot different. I lived under a bush and went downtown San Diego twice a week on the bus to scrape together $9 to give plasma when I was 18, and the bus ride was $1.50, so I was only netting $7.50 every trip, right? Which was enough to buy the no frills peanut butter, you know, and the plain vanilla cigarettes. more than really enough to get an apartment. You know what I'm saying? And if you ask me about financial insecurity at that point in my life, where am I going? Right? Are they going to reject me at the plasma center? What am I going to do then? Well, I'd already been hopping fences and dumpster diving. Right? I got an out for that. Financial security at that point doesn't look that bad. Right? But what ends up happening? Right? Now, I come into the rooms in 1985, and I go from being, you know, making about $5,000 a week under, you know, non-taxable income, by the way, in non-legal businesses, and the best job I can get is a $5 an hour closet painter. Because they won't let me paint the walls because the customer might see the walls. But whoever looks in the closet. I mean, that's my job after running a multi-state, I won't get into it. But that's my job. It was a bit of a letdown. You know, I was under the impression I should be running some corporation somewhere, you know. And they didn't see it that way. But financial security, when I got that first paycheck, and it was like $161, and after tax it was $123, and I go, Jesus, this is depressing, right? Financial security has a different place then. I'm not going to jail. I don't have a mortgage. I basically had nothing in the end, right? I had the thing that I was doing, that was it. Now I didn't have credit card debt. I didn't have a car payment. I didn't have anything, right? $123 a week, I'm in the game. You know, living back at mom's, isn't life good, right? But financial security at that point isn't the focus of what was going on in my life. You know, there are some other things that I'm gonna be concerned about. There are some other things that are major fear items, right? What happens though? I start to grow up. I start to get a job. I start to have a family. I start to have responsibilities, right? And in the nature of my understanding of the third column item, I start to have an understanding that when things change, what that fear looks like. Now imagine this, it's 2005, I've been back in the rooms for a year. You know, and I'm doing the deal, I'm doing inventory, I'm working with a sponsor, I'm going out on commitments, I'm trying to help other people, I'm trying to be of service, I'm trying to live by the stuff that I've seen in the steps and I've seen in the book. And my business is heading south like a World War II biplane in a black and white movie, you know, nosediving with smoke coming out of the tail towards the ground. And I'm losing enough money every day. I'm losing more money every day than I need to live per month. And all the things that I spent my entire financial career building are going away. And I remember, I was in the process of making my 9-step amends. And, I'm literally seeing myself go from broken, alcoholic in 1985, to successful businessman, broken spiritually, to financially broken, but potentially on his way to having a spiritual awakening. And that's what I see. And you know, I finally had one moment where I hit my knees and I said to God, I said, God, if you want me broke, I'm in the game. Just let me know what you need me to do. And the funny thing was, literally the next day, the whole thing started to change. It all started to change. But it gave me an understanding of what fear of financial insecurity looked like. And it gave me an opportunity to look at what each one of the third column items looks like over my life. Right? It's fear of financial insecurity is not this blanket statement that will always be the same thing. It will take on different manifestations and different levels depending on where I'm at in this world today. It'll also be indicative to me of what my spiritual awakening may look like at any given moment. It tells me where I am in the process today. Do I have fear of financial insecurity today? And the answer is no. Does that mean that I have an unlimited supply of funds? No. Does that mean that life is sometimes financially challenging? It actually is, right? I don't think there's a person in this room who can say to themselves they wouldn't want to have, you know, the alcoholic is the 110% person. You know what that means? Whatever you got, you want 110% of that. Right? You making $100,000 a year, you want 110. You got one wife, you want 1.1 wife. You know? You got a Jaguar, you want a Bentley. You know? You got a 1979 Ford Dart, you know, or good God. You want a heater core, you know? We're the 110% people. The truth of the matter is that That is the thing that brings about the fear, the knowledge that I will never get the 10%. And that's self-directed. And I think that I want to end here. We have, I really didn't do anything, actually, did I? Useless. I think we're going to end here and open it up for questions. And that's that. We have a minute for some deep and quizzical question.
I have a 2-minute question.
2-minute question for Martin.